Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 5th, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the Department of Labor's overtime rule. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and General Counsel, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. They are both shareholders at the Littler Mendelson Law Firm. We're going to have Maury Baskin for just the first half hour of our call today. He needs to leave at 12:30, but we welcome him along with Tammy D. McCutcheon, as I mentioned, both of Littler Mendelson. We're going to hear from Tammy McCutcheon first. She's going to give us some background and chronology on the case. Then Maury Baskin is going to cover the litigation itself. And then we'll revert to Tammy McCutcheon, who's going to talk about the regulatory side. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Tammy McCutcheon, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, very much. So we are back here again on a Federalist Society teleforum talking about the regulations that define who is an exempt employee as an executive, administrative, or professional employee, and that is exempt from the overtime requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So for those of you who aren't wage and hour geeks, let me just give you some background. In 1938, in the original Fair Labor Standards Act, Congress included an exemption from both minimum wage and overtime requirements for bona fide executive, administrative, and professional employees. Sometimes they're called the EAP exemptions, sometimes they're called the white collar exemptions, and if you're a real wage and hour geek, you call them the Part 541 exemptions. Because that is the part in the Code of Federal Regulations where these exemptions are defined. And you do need regulations on this because Congress totally punted. There is no definition in the Fair Labor Standards Act of who is an executive, administrative, or professional employee. Instead, Congress left the left it to the Secretary to define and delimit from time to time by regulation. So in 1940, yes, we're going way back, the Department of Labor published regulations at 29 CFR Part 541 containing three separate tests for exemption: the salary basis test, that you must be paid on a salary; the salary level test, that the employee must be paid at a minimum salary level to qualify for the exemption; and then a series of duties tests defining what duties an employee has to perform to be an executive or an administrative or a professional employee. And what we're talking here today is about Obama issued regulations defining that salary level test. How much salary do you have to make in order to be exempt under the FLSA? Now, just a little history. The salary level has been increased from time to time, every 4 to 10 years over the course of the history of this exemption. Before the Obama administration came in, the last time they had the salary level had been updated was in 2004, and that was when I was serving in the Bush administration as administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. And in 2004, we set that test at $4.55 a week, about $23,660 a year, but it is a weekly requirement. In 2015, the Obama administration proposed to update that salary level, and I think most people out there, even on the employer side, agreed that some increase to that minimum salary level was necessary because it hadn't been updated in over a decade. In May of 2016, the Obama administration did issue a final rule to revise that minimum salary level, changing it more than doubling it from $4.55 a week to $9.13 a week, or $47,700 annually. And what that meant under these rules is everybody making less than that $9.13 a week, $47,000 a year, had to be paid overtime, regardless of whether they were performing high-level duties. And of course, that was greatly opposed by the Chamber of Commerce, who is our client here at Littler, and many, many other business organizations. And so I'm going to turn it over to Mari to talk about how we challenged this rule in litigation and what's going on with that litigation.
Thanks, Tammy. And there's quite a bit going on even just now. As some of you may know, there was a ruling by the judge in our case just before the Labor Day weekend, and we even have news for you that just happened this morning. But I'll just briefly sum up how we got from where we were to where we are. Tammy's just explained they came out with this new rule in the Obama administration in 2016. And we pulled together a broad coalition, really the chamber pulled it together, 55 different business organizations who were upset about this, representing all aspects of industry, including nonprofits and many, many different types of industries. Millions of employers who were upset about the impact of this, what was viewed as a pretty radical change, as doubling, in effect, of the salary level. We filed a suit in the district court, the Eastern District of Texas, and ironically, at about the same time, and kind of independently, a group of state attorneys generals got together to who were also upset about the rule, and we've made contact with each other, and we filed in the same court, and ultimately the cases were consolidated. Our theories were a little bit different in each case. They had some extra governmental issues to raise, and ours was focused, of course, on the business side. They pushed a little harder for the notion that there was no authority, arguably, for a salary test at all. And our position from the get-go was that while the salary test, there's nothing in the Act talks about a salary test, it had been developed in as early as 1940, and as long as it was a test that was low enough to screen out just the obviously non-exempt people, then it was not an offensive test. It was not inconsistent with the Act. And so we kind of had this two-pronged attack, and we pulled an Obama appointee, Judge Mazant, and so people, some on the other side said, well, now the rule is going to survive. But in fact, in November of last year, Judge Mazant issued an excellent opinion granting the state's motion for preliminary injunction. It was just in the nick of time because the rule was going to go into effect December 1 of last year. In fact, it was such a close call that a number of businesses and associations had gone ahead and made changes, assuming that the rule was going to go into effect. But it did not. The judge issued this preliminary injunction, and he said, while he expressed a lot of concern in his order that maybe they didn't really have authority to put any sort of salary in there, he specifically dropped a footnote to say, I am not, in the end, holding that they don't have authority, that the department does not have authority to put a salary level test in. But what he did find was that the number they had picked, which was such a radical increase, was no longer serving the original intent of Congress. And for that reason, he issued the preliminary injunction. So that was back November of last year. And then there was an election. And obviously, with the new president coming in, there were some months of delay, frankly, until the Secretary of Labor was appointed. Meanwhile, an appeal was filed by the Obama administration. One of their last acts was to file the appeal to the Fifth Circuit to say that the preliminary injunction had been wrongly granted. And almost the entire thrust of the appeal was that the judge had declared that the department had no authority to issue a salary test at all. As you just heard, that's not what he said. But that was the basis on which they really filed the appeal. 6 months went by, and finally we had a Secretary of Labor, and he said at his confirmation hearings that he felt he was obliged to consider the judge's ruling and consider the executive orders to review and reconsider this whole issue. But meanwhile, the appeal was still going forward at the Fifth Circuit. As late as a month ago, they filed their final reply brief. And there was the argument date was set for this coming October 2nd. So there was concern about where was this thing heading. Meanwhile, and Tammy's going to talk more about it, the department issued a request for information saying that they wanted information necessary to possibly rescind the rule and try again. So they're going forward on these two separate tracks, and it was starting to get a little dicey as to which side was going to win the race here, kind of a slow-walking race, but still, raising concerns. And then the judge issued his final summary judgment today, not today, but on August 31st, just before Labor Day weekend. He did it even though it was pending at the Fifth Circuit, because the Fifth Circuit was only considering the preliminary injunction, and in fact, the judge retained jurisdiction over summary judgment, and we, the business community, had filed the summary judgment motion that had been fully briefed for some time. And so, to our gratification, the judge did grant summary judgment on the theories that we had pushed. Namely, he clarified and answered a lot of questions that had arisen about his preliminary injunction order. First, he clarified that no, he was not saying that they lacked all authority to create a salary threshold. But he reaffirmed what he had said before, namely that they had increased it way too high and that they did not have authority to have a salary threshold that removed the job duties, in effect, that was no longer a proxy for the job duties, that was no longer screening out only the most obviously non-exempt people. So he made his summary judgment order a final judgment, and in doing so, he also made clear that the original preliminary injunction had prevented the rule from going into effect. As a side note, there had been a case filed against Chipotle by some creative plaintiff lawyers who argued that the preliminary injunction from last November had somehow failed to prevent the rule from going into effect on December 1st, despite what everyone thought. And so they were proceeding with a case against Chipotle, saying that that they had failed to follow this rule that everyone thought had been enjoined, and also that the injunction only applied to the Labor Department and didn't somehow protect the businesses, the business community, from private lawsuits. Well, the judge in this newest order made clear also that his injunction had prevented the rule from ever going into effect, and that it had nationwide effect protecting all businesses and also all state governments, because the cases, the two cases, have been consolidated. So very good news all around if you're an employer and if you're worried about this change in the exemption status. Now, then the question, so here are the questions that have come up since this new judgment, summary judgment, came out. The first one is, what's the status at the Fifth Circuit? Well, and that's where we have brand new news. The although we knew it was coming, the just today, the Department of Labor filed a motion with the court to dismiss its appeal from the preliminary injunction, to dismiss it as moot. And there is ample precedent in the Fifth Circuit that when just this type of situation, when a preliminary injunction is even one that's been appealed, and even while that appeal is pending, if it's been converted to summary to final judgment, that is a new kettle of fish, if you will. It moots the preliminary. There's no longer a preliminary injunction to appeal from. There's now a final judgment. And so this has happened in the Persuader case, which is another Labor Department regulation, under very similar circumstances. Preliminary injunction at first, appeal filed from that, and then a final summary judgment. The preliminary injunction appeal was dismissed and not opposed by the Department of Labor. And that's exactly where we're at now. So that should be granted. I can't see why it wouldn't be, by the court. They did it in the other case. And then they have a choice whether to appeal, whether the Labor Department wants to appeal from this new final summary judgment. But it's effectively, they have to start all over. And in the meantime, the hope is that the department, which has begun the rulemaking process to have a new rule, Tammy's going to talk to you more about, that they're going to resolve this situation. And frankly, because the department is on record, even during the appeal, as saying they no longer were defending the number that they had previously picked, and with the judge disclaiming any intrusion on the department's authority to set a salary test, as long as it's a more moderate one, it's really hard to see why they should appeal or would want to appeal. But they have 60 days, and I guess that takes them up to Halloween, so we won't know for sure whether they will appeal. Now, you might be wondering, well, where are the unions and employee rights groups and all of this? And they did seek to intervene in the district court case, but their motions to intervene were denied at the same time that he granted our summary judgment. And so they could conceivably file appeals of their own, but again, you know, as long as the department keeps moving along on the regulatory front, they have a high mountain to climb at a minimum. I mean, what we've seen in other cases is any appeals are held in abeyance to await the outcome because the courts don't want to be ruling on a rule that is being rescinded. And so that would be a challenge for them. Can there be a salary threshold? I've already said what the district court thinks that there can be, although there are still some who are arguing, including in comments that are in the record already of the new rulemaking, some are arguing that there is no right to set a salary threshold of any kind. I doubt if the Labor Department's going to accept that view, but that view continues to be expressed. And then the question is, well, what next? It's going to be a regulatory battle, but we think that for the time being, the litigation has ended, though it still remains to be seen whether somebody, whether it's the department or the unions, is going to file an appeal of some sort. Happy to take any brief questions before we jump into the regulatory part.
I actually have one for you, Maury.
Okay.
The Chipotle case has been filed in New Jersey.
Right.
Right? Could the New Jersey District Court enter a ruling contrary to Judge Mazant in Texas?
Well, never put it past a federal judge to do anything. One reason, out of concern about that, the Chipotle lawyers filed a contempt motion in the Texas court against the plaintiffs in the New Jersey court. Kind of a novel approach, but it may have helped to stir the judge to issue his summary judgment ruling because he could see that things were getting kind of chaotic with an appeal in one direction and now this case in New Jersey and the potential for some others around the country. It's interesting, he granted our summary judgment and dismissed the case or closed the case without issuing a ruling on the contempt motion. So we're not quite sure as to where that stands, although he did help them by saying, look, I enjoined this thing nationwide. It was for the protection of private plaintiffs. So on the substance, the Chipotle case, it just seems like it cannot stand. Now, whether the New Jersey judge will feel that they have authority to do something on their own and creating thereby a conflict between the two, one cannot completely rule that out, but it just seems very unlikely because the law is pretty clear that there's nationwide authority of the district court who had jurisdiction over the rule itself. So he had the authority to enjoin the rule. And if that rule is not in effect, it's hard to see how a court in any other jurisdiction can magically say that that employers have violated a rule that does not that never went into effect. So one way or the other, it would seem that Chipotle is in a lot better prospect of prevailing, along with many other businesses who were getting a little nervous seeing that happening.
One other question for you, and then, Dean, we can open it up to questions briefly while Maury is still here. One of the things that we were concerned about with this race, would the litigation move ahead and have a decision before DOL could issue a new regulation was this line of cases that you wrote an article about in BNA in the home care industry about what happens when an injunction against a federal final rule is lifted. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, this was something that was of more concern before this recent order. But in another case dealing with overtime and dealing with the Fair Labor Standards Act, a different exemption in the home care industry, there was a district court order granting preliminary injunction and summary judgment that was 9 months later overturned by an appeals court. And lo and behold, private plaintiffs went back to who were filing suit, said to judges around the country that, well, we should be able to go back and collect overtime and higher pay back to the beginning of the year when the district judge issued his order. In other words, they said that the appeals court ruling should have retroactive effect, notwithstanding the fact that there had been an injunction in place. There's been a split among the district courts. There's been some 15 of them, and it's literally like an 8-7 split, meaning there's a substantial body of opinion that appeals court rulings are retroactive, and therefore the injunction somehow had no effect at all, unbeknownst to employers, and that they owe money all the way back to the beginning. Though at the moment, the bare majority, but it's still a majority view, is that no, while the injunction is in effect, the rule is null and void, and when the appeals court rules, if they reverse the district judge, it's unreasonable to force employers to go back retroactively, and so it should not take effect until the Labor Department begins to enforce its new rule, which in that case was 9 months later. But this issue is still being litigated, has not yet reached an appeals court. It's been all these different district courts going in different directions, and we did do a fairly lengthy article in BNA to analyze the two. We do think the better view is that it should not be retroactive. So there's still conceivably that possibility here, even if they appeal from the summary judgment. But we also here have the prospect that the Labor Department has already announced that it is requesting information in order to redo the rule, and that would seem to render moot the whole business, unlike the other case where the department, having won the appeal, they never backed down, and they were still pushing, and that was all taking place during the Obama administration. I think we'll have a different result this time around.
Great. Dean?
Yes, thanks, Tammy, and thank you, Maury Baskin. Let's open the floor to questions on the issues we've discussed to this point, and we'll get to the regulatory matters in a moment. But in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, especially for Maury Baskin, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, before we turn to the regulatory regime coming up, we'll take questions for Maury Baskin. We start with two, so let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, caller, if you're dialing in from 570. Oh, looks like that caller disconnected themselves, so we urge you to call back. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone, and if you've muted your own phone, you need to come off mute. Let's move on to the second caller.
Yes, I have a question. You had mentioned that the salary threshold is not applicable to these professions, and I'm just wondering where I can hire a doctor and a lawyer for $52,000 a year each, because according to your arguments, that's the going rate for doctors. I could use a private doctor for $52,000. Where do I hire one?
Well, actually, for doctors and lawyers, the salary level tests have never applied to them ever since 1938. I don't know the reasoning of the folks who were doing the regulations in 1938, but they have never applied any salary level test to doctors and lawyers. I assume it's because they feel they have sufficient bargaining power of their own and they don't need the protections of the FLSA, but who knows what the thoughts were back in 1938.
And it does bring up an important point, you know, on this whole ongoing rulemaking and litigation. It's never been about changing the duties tests or the requirement of a salary. And there are certain categories, aside from doctors and lawyers, who don't require a salary, for example, teachers and others. They've made no changes to those aspects of it. So it was just that if you were exempt based in part on the salary threshold, they were raising that number. In that sense, it was a simple rule, I suppose. But they backed off from making changes to other aspects of the exemption.
Even let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Did you have a follow-up question, caller?
To expand on that a little bit, even the other ones in the administrative exemption, the labor relations experts, the human resource managers, where can you hire a labor relations expert for $52,000 a year?
In the South.
In the South, right.
In the South. And also, if people who work for nonprofits are at a much lower salary level. And that's, I think, the debate. And I'll talk about this a little long, but one of the questions the Department of Labor has asked is if there should be regional differences based on, because the cost of living is a lot different in rural Mississippi, and the salary levels are a lot different in rural Mississippi than they are in Manhattan and San Francisco. So that's the debate.
Well, okay, we'll make a final call for questions before we lose Maury Baskin. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Okay. Well,
I want that debate to Tammy.
Well, and that brings us really, Dean, to what's happening on the regulatory side. Now, basically, these are regulations that can only be changed by compliance with the Federal Administrative Procedures Act. And that means you have to publish a proposal in the Federal Register and invite employers to provide comments before you publish a final rule. And what DOL has done actually in this case is they've started the regulatory process with a preliminary non-required step of issuing this request for information. A request for information is not the official start of a regulatory process. It is merely a request and an invitation to the public to file comments about the Obama era final rule. And in this case, they've asked 11 specific questions. But basically, what they're looking for was they want to know how many employers implemented it. What was the impact? Did they reclassify? Did they give wages? And they want information about what people and the members of the public think the salary level should be. Should it be remaining at 913? Should they just go back to 2004? Or should they do something in between in terms of the salary level? Now, the comments on those are due on September 25th, so we have basically the rest of this month to file comments. What we've seen so far, and you can actually do that online. You can go to regulation.gov and go to that page and submit a comment. And it doesn't have to be like a formal letter. What we're seeing right now, they've already gotten over 130,000 comments. The majority of those, however, are, and you can just file a comment by filling in a text box. Put in your name, put in the text box, hit post, and it's posted and can be viewed online. The vast majority of the 130,000 comments that they had as of last week were form comments based on a blog that was posted by an organization, a union-funded economics shop called the Economics Policy Institute. And they're basically, and the reason I know they're all the same is they all start with, with a reference to President Ford. So you can search the database and put in the words President Ford, and you'll see that like 115,000 of the 130 comments are the same paragraph form, which I don't, from my experience doing regulations at DOL, we called those votes, but they don't have any substance to them really, so you don't pay attention to them. So the real substantive comments will start to come in like the week before and until September 25th, and that's when you'll get major comments from the AFL-CIO, and the comments we'll be drafting here at Littler on behalf of the chamber. But what does DOL do with this information? They've got a lot of information. right? In 2005, when the Obama administration issued their proposed rule, I think they ended up with like 250,000 comments. So DOL has that record they can look to. And then they'll have the new comments from this request for information. And from those comments, they will build, presumably, a notice of proposed rulemaking, which will propose a specific new salary level to replace the 913, to stay with 913, which I think is unlikely, given Secretary Acosta's comments during his confirmation hearing, where he referenced increasing 2004 for inflation. There are, I think, some people who are still advocating to leave it at the 2004 level. I think it'll be somewhere in between 2004, the current 455 level, and the 913 in the 2006 final rule level. If you want my prediction, I think it's going to be somewhere in the mid to high 30s rather than the 47,000. But when is it going to happen? That's a big question, right? Because they will not have the comment period of the request for information will not close until September 25th. And then they have to take some time to read those comments and consider them before they issue a notice of proposed rulemaking. And with the notice of proposed rulemaking, they'll probably set another 60 or 90 day comment period. Then they have to read all those comments again before they issue a final rule. Historically with this, in 2004 with my regulation and in 2015 with the Obama administration's regulations, basically a year between publication of the notice of proposed rulemaking and the final rule. So it's unlikely, given the timeline, that we will see a new final rule this year. I think it's possible that we will see DOL publish a notice of proposed rulemaking with a specific salary proposed salary level in it, but I think it's fairly unlikely that we'll have a final rule this year. I think it will go on into 2018. So that's the status, and hopefully, you know, right now I think DOL is probably feeling a relief from time pressure because they've moved to dismiss the Fifth Circuit appeal. If they want to appeal the final summary judgment motion and the permanent injunction, as Maury indicated, they have to start all over again, which means a briefing period, oral arguments, and then, of course, the final decision by the Fifth Circuit. So right now, we were worried before that we'd get a Fifth Circuit decision well before DOL could issue a final rule. Now I think the race is sort of evening up. Assuming that DOL appeals, which I'm not sure what's going to – I don't think anybody knows whether DOL is going to appeal from the permanent injunction decision by the Texas court. And with that, that's sort of the news on the overtime, and I'm ready to take some questions, Dean, if anybody else has questions.
Well, thank you very much. I think our floor mode is still on, so people can ask questions at this point just by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I think we've lost Maury Baskin, but we still have Tammy McCutcheon on the phone. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. Before we go to our next caller, let me make a quick commercial announcement. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Thursday at 1 o'clock. We'll be discussing patent law and antitrust, really focusing on the view that patent rights are property rights. Today, of course, we're talking about the overtime rule with Tammy McCutcheon now. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. Let's take our first call of this part of the session.
And Dean, I just went on the regulations.gov website. So as of this moment, there are 138,259 comments on the request for information.
And building, it sounds like.
And building every day.
We've got a caller from area code 614. Go ahead, caller.
I just wondered what the professional salary cutoff would be if the 2004 salary cutoff were indexed
to inflation. I think I haven't gotten those numbers yet from the chamber economist who is working on that for me. But in general, it would probably be in the low 30s, like 32, 33. I will say that historically, the Department of Labor has only used an inflationary measure to update the salary level on one occasion out of the many times that the salary level was updated, and that was in 1975, and it stated in the final rule that they were, it was a very special situation. The administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at that time had been nominated and was leaving the Department of Labor to serve as chair of the National Labor Relations Board, and she really wanted to get a salary increase out. So they issued it very quickly without a lot of consideration, and the final rule said that they were only using inflation because of the time crunch and that it was not to be seen as a precedent. Historically, over the history of the salary level, DOL generally has tried to get information on actual salary levels paid to employees out there, and then setting the salary level at some percentage of that. In 1958, they set it at 10% of salary of lower wage industries in smaller cities and small towns. So they looked at data, salary data by industry, by geographic area, and by industry. In 2004, when we set it, we doubled it from 10% to 20%. Because of changes we were making in the duties test at that time, and we looked at salaries in the South and in retail rural to make sure that we were drafting a rule that would work in the rural areas as much as the cities. In terms of general information about salaries, generally the lower salaried industries are restaurant, retail, some healthcare, nonprofits. And then in the rural South and the rural Midwest, where the cost of living is so much less than in the big cities, we looked at that too. So I'm in DOL in their information request. They have asked whether or not they should use inflation to increase the salary level, or if they should use the 2004 methodology that we used. And then they've also asked for opinions about whether they should set different salaries for different regions. I personally think that's a little problematic because it's really not a region-by-region difference in terms of salary levels. It's the big difference is rural versus urban. So we'll see what they do, but they've asked for the public to give opinions about the various options for the methodology that they will use to set the salary level.
Thank you.
We've still got a couple questions pending. Let's take another call now.
I'm wondering to what degree, if any, they've considered the problem of if you have a salaried employee, and you have these rules at whatever level they're at. Although obviously the higher they are, the more significant they become. You're discouraging people from hiring people on a salaried basis if their employment tends to be very uneven. You work 50 hours one week, 20 the next, averaging under 40 hours a week. You would not want that person to be on salary because you get killed by these overtime rules. Has that been a factor that's been considered? Do you know?
I think it has been considered, not only in the comments in 2015, and I think we'll see more of that in the comments to this request for information, but it's also something that jurisdictional congressional committees have considered in their hearings. I testified before the Senate Small Business Committee, and next to me was the co-owner of John Besh's restaurants. He's a celebrity chef out of New Orleans, who talked about how the higher salary levels would impact his restaurant businesses. And one of the things that that came up in that hearing, and also it came up is that in the restaurant industry there is a lot of overtime. But a lot of times having to pay that much overtime to newly people would basically prevent them from treating them as exempt, and they would be on they would switch them to hourly and start paying overtime, and that would force them to limit opportunities for, like, young chefs, like line cooks, restaurant assistant managers. It would limit their opportunities to go up the chain of the organization, to come from a line cook to a sous chef to a chef, because they wouldn't be able to work the hours needed to show that they are a good employee and should be promoted. Now, I don't, obviously people have different views about that, but it's definitely a topic of discussion about how, if you had to reclassify and pay overtime, what impact will that have on the morale of employees, on the employee's ability to stand out and walk up the corporate chain of command versus other employees. If all the employees are just working under 40 hours, how do you, from an exempt perspective, how do you show that you are the person who should be promoted? I thought that was a very interesting discussion. And I'm sure that, I think it's, you can probably watch that hearing on C-SPAN.
Let me make another call for questions. We dropped a caller there. So if you have a question, this might be the final call for questions. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one more question, but let me ask a quick question of you, Tammy. Is there any discussion about the benefits of being a salaried employee versus a wage employee in all of this discussion? I know Diane Furchgott-Roth mentioned some of those benefits one way versus the other. Is that, does that ever get considered in these?
I think it does. I think you see discussion of that in a lot of the comments from 2015 by the business associations and in these congressional hearings. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody who is on the other side of this issue actually believes it. But here's the thing. When you're an exempt employee, right, it's that salary basis test. When you're an exempt employee, you have to be paid your entire salary guaranteed in any week in which you perform any work at all. So, you know, you send one email and you have to be paid your full salary for that week. If you want to leave work to go and attend a baseball game of your child, your employer can't dock your salary because you left work early. If you just want to go out for drinks on a Friday, you have to be, you know, I guess an employer could discipline you for not working enough hours, even if you're exempt, but you still have to be paid that guaranteed weekly salary. On the other hand, of course, if you're a non-exempt employee, if you don't work, you don't get paid because you're paid by the hour. And in even if you're a non-exempt employee that gets a salary, your employer can dock your salary if you do not for every hour that you do not work. So that's really the quid pro quo. If you're non-exempt, you get paid more for working more than 40 hours. If you're exempt, you cannot be paid less if you work less than 40 hours. So that's one. So to me, especially as a woman, an exempt employee has a lot more flexibility about when, where, and how that they work than a non-exempt employee does.
Is there an opportunity for people to make an election? I mean,
Nope. You cannot waive. I just had a colleague in my office this morning talking about a collective bargaining agreement. Employees cannot waive any of their rights under the FLSA. They cannot. You cannot offer to work over 40 and not get overtime pay. That's not legal. And even unions cannot waive the FLSA entitlements of their members. So FLSA trumps any individual agreement between an employer and employee, and it also trumps any agreement in a collective bargaining. So we have seen things here at Littler where there's an arm's length collective bargaining agreement that has some sort of compensation in it that violates the FLSA, and then union can come back later and sue you and recover back wages even though they agreed to the contract.
That's interesting. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, so let's return to the audience.
Yeah, just a simple thing on the chef thing. It wouldn't an easy way to determine who should be promoted would be just to taste their food. It sounds like people are making arguments that say, you know, that are shifting the policy. Congress passed a law for overtime, not for promotion selection. So, yeah, aren't there plenty of viable methods for promotion other than?
I think there are arguments on both sides. I really do. And, you know, we have heard from, and as I said, I think a lot of folks in Congress don't buy those arguments or believe them. On the other hand, we have heard from assistant managers in particular in restaurant and retail who were mad as hell at being reclassified. Some of the other things they lose is a lot of time because you have to pay when you pay a bonus to a non-exempt employee, you owe them extra overtime on the bonus. That I call that the no good deed goes unpunished rule. So a lot of times when somebody is reclassified from exempt to non-exempt, they lose bonuses. They have a less, they lose vacation, paid vacation days because a lot of businesses have different and better benefits for the exempts. Their health care might change. Their profit sharing plans might change. So the impact, it's, and we've heard that the opportunities for promotion are become restricted when somebody goes into an hourly job. So it is. I don't think it's all clear cut, but I think there are some real disadvantages, including the flexibility to take care of your kids when they need to, that you lose when you go from exempt to non-exempt. And actually, it's interesting that you asked this question because as Mari mentioned, there were some employers who did reclassify employees and or make wage increases in response, in anticipation of the 2006 rule. And that's where we heard back from assistant managers and says, hey, wait a second, I liked being exempt. There's also a perception, I think, among many employees, is that when you get into the exempt category, that you've made it, you're part of management, right? They view it as a promotional thing. And employers have to fight back against that because obviously the distinction between exempt and non-exempt is a legal one and it has nothing to do with your status in the company. But it is a perception that employers really need to fight against when they're reclassifying. So I would love to hear more from employees, right? Do you want to be exempt or would you prefer to be non-exempt? Would you prefer, flexibility of work hours versus additional pay? And that gets you into the whole comp time debate, too, that seems to be perennially ongoing. But nobody's really done that, I don't think. I don't think anybody's really gone out to employees and said, okay, this is what happens if you're non-exempt. This is what happens if you're exempt. Which one would you rather be? I wish somebody would do that survey. All right, back to you, Dean. Sorry, go ahead.
It's just the mantra of the federal society is that the judges should say what the law is, not what it should be. And everything you said is maybe great policy things, and there may be a bunch of people in Congress that agree with them. But until Congress passes a law, just in the context of the FLSA that we have now, how is what the law, the way it's written, how is that different from, the Department of Labor's interpretation? This is bona fide executives, an executive of a company, a CEO, a CFO, and a bona fide, it doesn't say manager, it says executive. Bona fide executive of a company has to make $52,000 a year, maybe in the Deep South where everybody's underpaid, but wouldn't that just be a better policy argument to say what the regulations are doing is paying impoverished regions of the country, bringing their wages up? And isn't that the goal of the FLSA rather than?
On the minimum wage side it was, but on the overtime, the goal, as stated in the congressional history, is to spread the work. You penalize by making employers who make people work longer hours are penalized by having to pay that 1.5 rather than just straight time. And the purpose of that was to spread the work. But let's go back to the statute. In this case, Congress completely punted in 1938 when it put in this exemption. But it's clear that in 1938 they had in mind some group of employees or executives. And interestingly enough, when they finally amended the FLSA in the 1990s to allow the exemption for certain computer employees, they did actually set minimum wages in that. They have never done so for these. I think it would be, you know, any changes to the FLSA are very hard to impossible to get through Congress at this point because it's such a controversial issue. So I don't think we'll ever see Congress actually put in a minimum salary. And the problem is, too, it has to be updated, right? And so, you know, that would be hard to do through Congress. So it really is the Department of Labor's responsibility to regularly update the salary level. Part of the questions for the upcoming request for information is whether or not they should walk away from or continue to have the 3-year automatic updates to the salary level that was in the 2016 final rule from the Obama administration, and that's something to consider. But a part of me on the salary stuff thinks the more complex it is, the harder it is for people to comply with. So I'm not sure I'm personally in favor of different salary levels, automatic updates. I would like to see a simple rule that's easy for employers to comply with. And the debate about how high that salary level is will, I think, continue on through this year and into next. Dean.
Let me make another final call for a question for a final – I call for a final question. I apologize. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got a few minutes left. I think, Tammy, we've had our final question. So let me come back to you and see if you have a final thought or you want to wrap up.
Well, a couple of things. The key dates is if you want to comment on what should happen with this rule, you can do that at regulations.gov and just search for if you search on that database for the search term executive administrative professional employee, you'll probably find it. The official title of this RFI is Defining and Delimiting the Exceptions for Executive Administrative Professional Outside Sales and Computer Employees. So that deadline is September 25th. And then, of course, we'll continue to watch to see whether DOL files an appeal of the permanent injunction, and that deadline is October. So I think right now we're going to be – I think it's important for anybody, both sides, including you, our caller, with all your good questions, to go on and file comments before that September 25th date. But I think it will be clearly into October or November before we have further information about which direction the Department of Labor is going to go. And there will be people who say we should just stick with 2004 and do nothing. We should stick with 913 as set by the Obama administration. My prediction is most of the commenters will say it's time for an increase, but let's do something that's more modest so that it works everywhere in the country. And I said my prediction would be mid, you know, somewhere between 34 and 38. That's my prediction, Dean.
Very good. Well, thank you, Tammy McCutcheon. And if you would pass along our gratitude to your partner, Maury Baskin, we certainly appreciate your time here. It's been very, very topical, especially given the breaking news this morning. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Thursday at 1 o'clock. We'll be talking about antitrust and patent law. There's some breaking news there today as well, so we'll cover that on Thursday at 1 o'clock. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.